retorted, a little unfairly. Her mother's choices often were younger men, but not usually by more than a decade or so, and Carla herself had to admit that most of the options in the 50-plus male range weren't much to look at. The tunnel was 6 kilometers. They made the other side with teeth chattering, and Kirsty whooped as she drove into the fractured sunlight outside. The temperature upgrade soaked into Carla's body like tropical heat. The chill seemed to have gone bone deep. She tried to shrug it off. Get a fucking grip, Carla. She was already missing Chris, a lack for which she berated herself because it felt so pathetic alongside her mother's cheerful self-sufficiency. The anger at him that had driven her out of the house was already evaporating by the time her plane took off, and all she had by the time she arrived in Tromsø was maudlin drinking talk of distance and loss. Now, out of the mess she had laid out for her mother the night she arrived, Kirsty had snatched the possibility of meaningful action. Carla wondered vaguely what you had to do to attain operational pitch like that. Have a child? Write a book? Lose a relationship? What did it take? There it is, Kirsty gestured ahead, and Carla saw that the road was dropping down to meet one side of a small, stubby fjord. On the other side a huddle of institutional buildings were gathered, lit up shiny in a wandering shaft of sunlight. It looked as if the road ran all the way up to the end of the inlet and then back around to the monitoring station.
So this is all new as well?
Relocated. They were based in the Faroes until last year.
Why did...
Carla remembered. Oh, right, the BNR thing.
Yes, your beloved British and their nuclear reprocessing. Gerlau reckons it's contaminated local waters for the next 60 years minimum. Pointless taking overview readings. None of the tests they do will stand the radiation.
Not for the first time, Carla felt a wave of defensiveness rising in her at the mention of her adoptive home.
I heard it was just heat exchanger fluids, not enough to do much damage.
My dear, you've been living in London too long if you believe what the British media tell you. There is no just where nuclear contaminants are concerned. It's been a monumental disaster, and anyone with access to independent broadcasting knows it. Carla flushed.
We've got independent channels.
Does Chris buy off the jamming? Her mother looked interested.
I don't think you could do that effectively.
No, he's exempted, under license for his job.
Oh, I see.
There was a studied politeness in Kirsty's voice that didn't quite shroud her distaste. Carla flushed again, deeper this time. She said nothing more until the wheels of the Volvo crunched across the gravel parking lot beside the monitoring station. Then, sitting still in the passenger seat as Kirsty killed the engine, she muttered,
I'm still not sure this is such a good idea.
It was a good idea when we had it on Friday night, her mother said emphatically. It's still a good idea now. One of my best. Now come on. Kirsty's Tromsø University ID got them in the front door, and a quick search of the building's locational database at reception told them Truls Vasvik was up on the top floor. They took the stairs, Kirsty leading by a couple of steps on every flight. Good for the buttocks, she flung over her shoulder in response to her daughter's puffed protests to slow down. Only 5 levels? Come on. They found Vasvik in the staff café. He was, Carla thought, a classic Kirsty type, gaunt and long-limbed, radiating self-sufficiency like the effects of some drug recently injected. He wore a crew-necked sweater, canvas work trousers, walking boots, and an uncared-for heavy black coat that he somehow hadn't gotten around to removing. The clothes hung off him, incidental drapings on his lean frame, and his silver-threaded black hair was long and untidy. He looked to be in his early 40s. As they approached, he got up and offered a bony hand.
"Hello, Kirsty."
"Hello, Truls. This is my daughter, Carla. Carla Truls Vasvik. It's good to see you again."
Vasvik grunted.
"Have you seen Gerlau yet?"
"About an hour ago."
"Oh, sorry, I didn't realize."
"Shall we all sit down? There's machine coffee over there if you want it."
"Can I get you one?"
Vasvik indicated the cup in front of him and shook his head. Kirsty went off to the bank of self-service machines across the café and left Carla stranded. She offered Vasvik an awkward smile and seated herself at the table.
"So you've known my mother for a while?"
He stared back at her. "Long enough."
I appreciate you taking the time to see us."
"I had to be here anyway. It wasn't a problem."
"Yes, how's it going? I mean, can you talk about it?"
A shrug.
"It isn't strictly speaking confidential at this end, anyway. I need some data to back up a case we're putting together. Gierlo has it, he says."
"Is it a British thing?"
"This time around, no. French."
A marginal curiosity surfaced on his face.
"You live there, then?"
"Where, Britain? Yes, yes, I do."
"Doesn't it bother you?"
She bit her lip. Kirsty arrived with coffee cups and saved them both from the rapidly foundering conversation.
"So," she said brightly, "where are we up to?"
"We haven't started yet," said Vasvik.
Kirsty frowned.
"Are you okay, Truls?"
"Not really," he met her gaze. "Janicki died."
"Janicki Onarheim? Oh, shit, I'm sorry, Truls."
Kirsty reached out and put her hand on Vasvik's arm.
"What happened?"
He smiled bleakly.
"How do ombudsmen die, Kirsty? She was murdered. I only got the call this morning."
"Was she working?"
Vasvik nodded, staring into the plastic-topped table.
"Some American shoe factory up near Hanoi. The usual stuff. Reported human rights abuse, no local police cooperation."
He drew a deep breath.
"They found her car run off the road an hour out of town, nowhere near where she should have been. Looks like someone took her for a ride. Raped, shot, single cap, back of the head."
He glanced up at Carla, who had flinched at the word raped.
"Yeah, it's probably good you hear this. Janicki is the third this year. The Canadians have lost twice that number. UN ombudsmen earn their money, and often enough we don't get to spend it. From what Kirsty says, your man might not suit the work."
The implied slight to Chris, as always, fired her up.
"Well, I doubt you'd last long in conflict investment."
The other two looked at her with chilly Norwegian disapproval.
"Perhaps not," said Vasvik, finally. "It was not my intention to insult you or your man, but you should know what you are trying to get him into. Less than 50 years ago, this was still a comfortable, localized, office-based little profession. That's changed. Now, at this level, it can get you killed. There is no recognition of the work we do. At best, we are seen as fussy bureaucrats. At worst, as the enemies of capitalism and the bedfellows of terrorists. Our UN mandate is a bad joke. Only a handful of governments will act on our findings. The rest cave in to corporate pressure. Some, like the United States and so, of course, Britain, simply refuse point-blank to support the process. They are not even signatories to the agreement. They block us at every turn. They query our budgets. They demand a transparency that exposes our field agents. They offer legal and financial asylum to those offenders we do manage to indict. We shelve 2 out of every 3 cases for lack of viability. And..."
He jerked his chin, perhaps out to wherever Janicki Onarheim's body now lay.
"We bury our dead to the jeers of the popular media."
More silence. Across the café someone worked the coffee machine.
"Do you hate your job?"
Carla asked quietly. A thin smile.
"Not as much as I hate the people I chase."
"Chris, my husband, hates his job. So much that it's killing him."
"Then why doesn't he just quit?"
There was scant sympathy in the ombudsman's voice.
"That's so fucking easy for you to say."
Kirsty shot her a warning glance.
"Truls, Chris was born and brought up in the London cordon zones. You've seen that, you know what it's like, and you know what happens to the ones who manage to claw their way out. First-generation syndrome. If quitting means going back to the zones, he probably would rather die. He'd certainly rather kill. And in the end, we know how closely those two can be intertwined."
Another smile, somewhat less thin. "Yes, first-generation syndrome. I remember that particular lecture quite well for some reason." Kirsty joined him in the smile. She flexed her body beneath her sweater in a fashion that made her daughter blush slightly.
"Thanks," she said. "I hadn't realized it was that memorable."
It was as if something heavy had dropped from Vasvik's shoulders. He sat up a little in the molded plastic chair, turned back to Carla.
"All right," he said. "I don't deny it. Someone like your husband could be useful to us. The information he has alone would probably be enough to build a couple of dozen cases, and yes, a background in conflict investment would go a long way to making a good ombudsman. But I can't promise you, him, a job. For one thing, we'd need an extraction team to get him away from Sean. But yes, if he really wants out, I can ask around. I can set some wheels in motion."
It was what she wanted to hear, but somehow it didn't fill her with the feeling she'd expected. Something about Vasvik's clamped anger, the news of sudden death, or maybe the bleak landscape outside. Something was not right. And later, when they got up to go and Kirsty and Truls embraced with genuine affection, she turned away so that she would not have to watch. Chapter 21. Monday was soft summer rain, and a nagging pain behind the eyes. He drove in with a vague sense of exposure all the way, and when he parked and alarmed the car, tiny twitches of the same discomfort sent him scanning the corners of the car deck for watchers. This early, there was nobody about. There were phone messages on the data down. Liz Linshaw, drawling, ironic, and inviting. Joaquin Lopez, from the name. He shelved Liz and told the data down to dial up Lopez's cell. The America's agent had called 4 times in the last 2 hours, and sounded close to panic. He grabbed the phone at the third ring, voice tight and shaky.
"See, Degami?"
"It's Faulkner."
"Jesus, Joaquin, what the fuck's the matter with you?" "Escuchame."
There was the sound of movement. Chris got the impression Lopez was in a hotel room, getting up from the bed, moving. The agent's voice firmed up as he crossed into English.
"Listen, Chris, I think I'm in trouble. I got down here last night, been making some inquiries about Diaz, and now I got a clutch of Echevarria's political police all over me like putas on payday. They're in the bar across the street, downstairs in the lounge. I think a couple of them have taken a room on this floor. I don't—"
"Joaquin, calm down. I understand the situation."
"No, you don't fucking understand my situation, man. This is the name. These guys will cut my fucking cojones off if they get the chance. They bundle me into a car and that's it. I'm fucking history, man."
"Joaquin, will you just shut up and listen?" Chris went directly from the command snap to enabled conciliatory without allowing the other man a response. Textbook stuff. "I know you're scared. I understand why. Now let's do something about it. What do these guys look like?"
"Look like?"
A panicky snort.
"They look like fucking political police. What do you want me to say? Ray-Bans, bellies, and fucking mustaches. Get the picture?"
Chris did get the picture. He'd seen these cut-rate bad guys in operation on his own trip to the Monitored Economy with Hammett McCall. He knew the gut-sliding sense of menace they could generate simply by appearing on the scene.
"No, Joaquin, I meant, did you get pictures? Have you got your shades set down there?" "Yeah, I brought them."
A pause.
"I didn't use them yet."
"Right."
"I freaked. I'm sorry, Chris. I fucked up. I didn't think."
"Well, think now, Joaquin. Get a grip. You can fuck up on your own time. Right now you're on the Sean clock. I'm not paying you to get your ass killed." Chris glanced at his watch.
"What time is it there? 1 a.m.? "A little after."
"Right. How many of these mustaches are there?"
"I don't know. 2 down in the lobby."
The panic started to seep back into Lopez's voice.
"Maybe another 2 or 3 more across the road."
"Can you get me pictures?"
"I'm not fucking going outside, man."
"All right, all right." Chris paced, thinking, trying to put himself in the hotel room with Lopez. The Nikon sunglasses and the data transmission gear had been a Christmas gift from Sean. They were very high spec. "Look, can you see the ones in the bar from your window? Go and check." More movement. Lopez came back calmer.
Yeah, I can see that table. I think I can get a decent shot from here.
All right, that's good. Do that. Chris cranked his voice down as soothing as possible. Then, I want you to go down to the lobby and get full frontals of the other two. They shouldn't try anything there. Are you armed?
Are you kidding? I came through U.S. security at the airport, just like everybody else.
Fine, doesn't matter. Just get the pictures and mail them through to me as quickly as you can. I'll be waiting. And Joaquin, remember what I said. You don't get killed on the Shawn clock. We'll pull you out of there. Got it?
Got it.
A brief pause in which he could hear Lopez breathing down the line.
Chris? Thanks, man.
De nada. Stay cool. Chris waited until he heard the disconnect. Then he slammed a foot against the desk leg, knotted a fist.
Fuck!
Another kick.
Fuck!
Back to the data down. He estimated Lopez's performance time, placed forward calls. Then he went to the window and stared out at the London skyline until the phone chimed. The images came through, two clear face and trunk shots that must have been taken from less than 5 meters. Lopez had gotten close. The two parapoliticals were grinning unpleasantly into the Nikon's hidden lens. Their teeth showed spotted brown with decay. The cafe photo was less to rejoice about, but there was a pavement table centered in the shot, 3 clear figures around it, faces turned in the camera's direction. The first of the forward calls went through. Even with the forewarning, the other end took a while to pick up, and the first sound to come through was a noisy yawn. Chris smiled for the first time that day.
Burgess Imaging.
The screen caught up, filled with a dark, unshaven face in its late teens.
Oh, hello, Chris. What can I do? Those satellite blow-ups okay?
Yeah, fine, it's not that. Listen, can you do me step-ups of a street shot right now? Faces good enough for machine ID. Jamie Burgess yawned again and scratched at something in the corner of one eye.
Cost you?
I guessed. Look, I'm wiring it through on inset. Just take a look. Burgess waited, blinked at the screen a couple of times, and nodded.
Nikon shot, yeah?
Yeah.
Give me 2 minutes. Leave the line open.
Thanks, Jamie. Another yawn.
Pleasure.
Burgess was as good as his word. The data down spat back, perfect head-and-shoulder shots 90 seconds later. Chris punched them up next to the two he already had from the lobby and nodded.
Okay, motherfuckers. Let's hope you've been to church recently.
The second forward call picked up on the first ring. A grizzled, virtual head above crisp army khaki fatigues. The accent was American, the real-life version of Mike Bryant's Simeon Sands burlesque.
Langley Contracting.
This is Chris Faulkner, Shawn Associates, London. Do you have operational units in the Medellin area?
There was a pause, presumably while Chris's scrambler code and authorization cleared at the other end. Then the virtual customer service agent nodded.
Yes, we can work in that area.
Good. I need 5 extreme prejudice deletions with immediate effect. Exact locational data and visual ID attached.
Very good. Please indicate the level of precision required.
This was a new refinement. Sorry?
Please indicate level of precision required from the following 5 options. Surgical, accurate, scattershot, blanket, atrocity.
Jesus, Chris gestured helplessly. Surgical.
Please note, the surgical option may incur a substantial time delay.
No, that's no good. This is with immediate effect.
Do you wish to supersede precision levels with an urgency marker?
Yes, I want this done now.
Charge card or account?
Account.
Your contract is enabled. Thank you for choosing Langley Contracting. Have a nice day.
Chris looked once more at the 5 faces floating on his screen. He nodded again and pressed a thumb down on each one to make it go away.
Adios, muchachos.
When the last face had wiped, he wired the data down line to his mobile and went out to get coffee from Louis Louis. Lopez called him about an hour later. Voice rampant down the line, whooping shrill with delight, sirens in the backdrop.
Chris, you're a beautiful man. You did it. Hijos de puta, they're all over the street, man. They're all over the fucking street.
What? Chris said faintly.
Drive-by, man! Fucking exemplary! They must have used one of those shoulder launchers. Whole fucking cafe's on fire. I'm telling you, there's nothing left but pieces.
He sat down heavily behind the desk. He saw it, lit in tones of night and flame. Pastiche newsreel footage, memories of 100 such scenes, bodies and bits thereof. Streak scorched black and red, screams and blundering panic from the sidelines. The hotel. It was almost a whisper, like words he couldn't be bothered to push out of his mouth. The people in the hotel.
Yeah, they got them too. I heard the shots. Spray guns.
Lopez made a stuttering machine gun noise. He was drunk on his own narrow escape.
Just been down to check right now. See, I was still looking out the window at the fire when...
No, Joaquin, stop. The other people in the hotel, you know, staff, other customers, did they hit anybody else?
Oh,
Lopez stopped.
I don't think so. I didn't see any other bodies. Man, who'd you call?
Never mind. It was like tasting ashes. He could smell the blast, smell the scorched flesh on the scented night air. Over the phone the sirens sobbed out, and he heard screaming in the space it left.
You best get out of there. Better yet, get back to Panama City. You're blown down there for now. You'll have to work through someone else.
Yeah, what I thought.
Lopez's voice shifted.
Listen, Chris. I lost it for a while back there, but I know my work. I didn't make one wrong move in the last 24 hours. Those hijos de puta, they knew I was coming.
Chris nodded drearily, for all it was an audio link. Right, Joaquin.
Give me another 2 days. We can still make this run. I know the right people. You don't have to worry.
He squeezed his eyes shut. Right.
Count on it, man. I'll hook you up, I swear.
Behind Lopez, someone started using an amp box to yell down the noise of the crowd. Chris reached out and cut the link. Brian and Makin got in about the same time. Chris went down to the car deck to meet them. Mike grinned when he saw them.
Hey, Chris. Jesus, what time did you get in?
He ignored the greeting and went straight for Makin, right fist in under the ribcage with the full force of the last stride behind it. Makin doubled up and vomited a spray of breakfast. Chris stepped back and hooked into his face from the side. The glasses flew. Makin hit the deck and rolled, retching. Chris got in a single kick, and then Mike had him pinioned from behind and was dragging him out of range.
That's it, Chris. Time out.
Fucking piece of shit. Sell out my agents, you fuck.
I don't...
Makin got to one knee, holding his face.
No... What the fuck you are talking about?
Chris renewed his efforts to break Mike's hold. Makin straightened, wiped his mouth, and looked up. He raised his free arm.
I'll see you on the fucking road for that, Faulkner.
Hey! Mike loosened his hold on Chris's shoulders. That's enough of that shit, Nick. Nobody sees anybody on the road in this team. Nobody. You save that shit for the tenders. Chris, I'm gonna let you go now, okay? Now you behave. No brawling on the car decks. It's undignified. This isn't the zones.
He let go of Chris and stepped away, carefully poised between the two men, arms spread slightly upward from the waist, ready. Makin prowled sideways and spat. Chris felt the reaction twitch through him from the fist back to the shoulder. Mike Bryant drew a deep breath.
Okay, guys. What the fuck is going on?
This piece of shit...
Chris was still adrenaline-fired, thrumming with a need to do violence.
Wired through our detail on Diaz to Echevarria.
Yeah? So?
Bryant blinked.
You did that, Nick?
Jesus, yes. You said to light a fire under Echevarria's ass.
Chris felt the fury drop out of him to make room for disbelief. He saw the same in Bryant's stare. The big man shook his head.
But...
Christ, Mike, I want the axe over his head by Monday. That's what you said. What was I supposed to do?
Chris flared.
That's fucking bullshit. You weren't in here on the weekend. How the fuck do you know where I was? What are you, my fucking mother?
I didn't see you Saturday, Bryant said quietly.
I took the stuff home, Mike. Look, Echevarria was holding rallies for the faithful all weekend. It seemed like a good time to waddle him. The uplink-on is tomorrow. What was I going to do? Wait and then try to paste it all together today? I've got Cambodian logistics to think about, a palace revolution in Yemen, the Kashmir thing. Guatemala coming apart again. I don't have time for this shit.
Chris surged forward a step, fetched up with Mike Bryant's arm across his chest.
I sent Joaquin Lopez down to the ME, fuckhead, asking after Diaz. He nearly fucking died today. That's supposed to be my fault?
Bryant sighed.
Diaz was off limits, Nick. He was our holdout if old scumbag didn't fold.
You knew that. Oh, what am I, a fucking telepath? No one told me not to use Diaz, and he's the strongest threat we've got.
All right, Mike rubbed at his face. Maybe we didn't make it clear enough. But you should have checked with Chris first. Same goes for you, Chris. You should have run it by Nick before you sent Lopez down there.
But
Chris couldn't identify the sudden feeling in his chest.
You told me to send him.
Well, yeah, but not without consultation.
Bryant looked back and forth between the two men.
Come on, people. A little communication, a little cooperation, for Christ's sake. Is that too much to ask?
Neither of the other men even glanced at him. Chris and Makin were either end of a hard-wired stare.
People died, Mike, because of this fucking clown.
Makin snorted. Bryant frowned.
I thought you said nearly.
Not Lopez. Other people. I had to call in Langley to get the goons off his back, and they blew up a whole fucking cafe.
Makin traded in his snort on a sneer. Bryant made a noise only slightly less dismissive.
Well, what do you expect? Come on, Chris. Langley? These guys used to be the CIA, for fuck's sake. Even before deregulation, they were a bunch of cack-fisted, incompetent fucking clowns.
He looked across at Makin, grinned, and made an imploring gesture with one hand.
I mean, Langley, for Christ's sake.
Chris felt himself losing his temper with his friend.
There was no fucking option, Mike, he snapped. No one else in the ME has the response time, you know that.
Yeah, well, that's one for the Monopolist Commission.
Mike pressed thumb and forefinger to the bridge of his nose.
Look, it's a shame about the cafe, but it could have been worse. I mean, with Langley, you're lucky they didn't kill Lopez for you as well.
Makin laughed out loud. Bryant joined in.
Fuck, the kind of punk sicarios they're contracting out to these days. You're lucky they didn't take out the whole block.
It isn't funny, Mike.
Oh, come on, it is a bit.
Bryant shelved his grin, sobered.
All right, a fuck-up is what it is, but we can cover the damage. We'll ride out any waves that Javaria makes tomorrow, keep it in the team, and we'll bury the Langley account. Pay it off, I don't know, through one of the Cambodia slush funds or something. No one else has to know. Clean hands all around come the quarterly. All right?
He looked around at his team.
Agreed?
Makin nodded. Chris, finally, too. Bryant's grin came back.
Good. But remember, gentlemen, a little more attention to detail next time, please.
Chapter 22. Hernan Echevarria, predictably, did not take it so well.
You sit this out,
said Mike, rather grimly, as they stood in the covert viewing chamber waiting for the uplink to go through.
We'll do the lying.
As usual, when faced with politics, he had slung his baseball bat across his shoulders cruciform, and now he prowled about, rolling his neck back against the polished wood.
On the other side of a one-way glass wall, Nick Makin busied himself with bottled water and screen control mice along one edge of the conference table. The rest of the slate-gray expanse was bare, but for the shallow slope of recessed display screens near the center.
"You think this is the breakpoint?" Chris asked.
Mike pulled a face.
"If yesterday's performance is anything to go by, it's pretty fucking close. It's only the fact he is actually yelling at us that makes me think we might still have a chance. If he was planning to walk, I don't think we'd even be talking.
Well, shouting. The call had come in a couple of hours before lunch, barely past dawn back in the name. Echevarria must have spent all night talking to his forensics experts in Medellin. Mike took it. Chris never heard the detail, but understood it had gone something like, "What the fuck did you gringo sons of whores think you were doing on my turf? Who the fuck do you think you are, talking to this Marquista traitor Diaz behind my back? If you were men of honour and not grey-suited scum, I would, etc., etc., blah, blah, apoplexy."
"Okay, not quite," Mike admitted. "Figure of speech. He hasn't dropped dead, fortunately, otherwise we really would be in trouble. I don't rate our chances of negotiating with Echevarria Jr. at all. So at the meeting, let's try to keep temperatures low. Conciliatory approach."
Later that day, they heard the news. The gunships had flown. The highlands west of Medellin were in flames, and the Monitored Economy's pet press were proclaiming Diaz either dead or fleeing for the Panamanian border, where he would be cornered and caged like the cowardly Marquista dog he was. In the cities, the arrests ran into triple figures.
"He'll be riding high. We've got that going for us."
Mike, trying for upbeat, as the three-minute countdown for the uplink commenced.
"Taste of blood in his teeth. With a bit of luck, he'll think he's invincible. With the right amount of cringing apology, I think we can talk him around."
Chris hauled up a chair and leaned on the back.
"You sure you don't want me in there instead of Macon?"
Bryant just looked at him.
"What?" Chris said.
"You going to let this go?"
"Mike, it isn't even my fucking account. In the end, I don't give a shit. But you're not going to tell me this wasn't deliberate."
"Oh, give me a fucking break with the conspiracy theories. Why can't you just accept it was a communications fuck-up? Is basic incompetence so hard to believe in?"
In the conference room, Macon stood facing them and rapped on the glass.
2 minutes, Mike."
Bryant leaned down to one of the mics and pressed trans.
"Be right there, Nick. Fasten your seatbelts, ladies and gentlemen."
He slipped the baseball bat off his shoulders and leaned it in a corner. Chris put a hand on his arm. "Mike, you saw his face when we ran it by him on Thursday. You were there. He resented the change of tack, and he made damn sure it blew up in our faces. He handed up Diaz so we'd have nothing else to work with, and you know it."
"And nearly blew out his own account. Cost himself maybe thousands in lost bonuses come quarterly. Chris, come on. It makes him look bad. Why would he do that? What's in it for him?"
Chris shook his head.
"I don't know, but..."
"Exactly." Mike gripped his shoulders. "You don't know. I don't know either. There is nothing to know. Now let it go."
"Mike, I've got no axe to grind here. I came..."
Another sharp rap on the glass.
"You are cutting it fine, Michael."
"I only came on board to help you, and I'm..."
The shoulders squeezed tighter. Mike met his eye.
"Chris, I know that, and I'm grateful, and I'm not blaming you for what happened. But you've got to let it go now. Get back to Cambodia. Start worrying about your own quarterly review."
"Mike."
"I'm out of time, Chris."
He squeezed once more, then darted for the door. Chris watched through the glass as he zipped into the seat next to Macon and settled, instants before the uplink chimed. One thing that all the conflict investment clients Chris had ever dealt with had in common was their love of developed-world techno-toys. It was basic CI wisdom handed down from partners to analysts everywhere in the trade. Don't stint on toys. At the top of every hardware gift list, you placed your state-of-the-art global communications gadgetry, that and personalized airliners, then the military stuff. Always that order. It never failed. Echevarria's uplink holocast was razor-sharp in resolution and came with about a dozen attached display screens. Chris knew his face, of course, from the HM files and occasional newscasts from the ME. Still, it had been a while since he'd seen Echevarria for real. He leaned in close to the glass wall and focused on the sagging, leathery face, the pouched eyes and clamped mouth, the scrawny neck held ramrod straight, disappearing into the neck of a dress uniform laden with medals and awards. The peripheral display screens fanned out behind him unignited like a black halo. The hands resting on the holocaust tabletop looked bloated.
"Ah, General," said Bryant with plastic charm, "there you are. Welcome."
Echevarria raised one hand to his lips and looked to his left. The uplink chime sounded again, and about a meter down the table, a second Holocaust image blipped and fizzled into existence.
"My son will be joining us for these proceedings,"
the dictator smiled, showing brilliant white teeth clearly not his own.
"If you gentlemen don't object."
The irony was heavy, but worse lay behind it. Francisco Echevarria was currently in Miami, Chris knew, and the speed with which the Holocaust had come in past Sean's data breaks uninvited suggested a level of intrusion equipment beyond that usually on offer to guests at the Miami Hilton. He's with the fucking Americans. Rimshaw or Meldrake, got to be. Chris scrabbled for a hold. Most likely Rimshaw. Lloyd fucking Paul. Calders aren't usually this flamboyant. The new Holocaust settled down. Francisco Echevarria emerged, darkly handsome in one of his habitual Susanna Ingram suits. His face was already flushed with anger, looking for discharge. Mike Bryant took it and ran with it.
"Of course, we are delighted to have Signor Echevarria with us as well. In fact, the more varied the input, at a time—"
"Hijo de puta!" spat Echevarria Jr. without preamble. "The only fucking input I have to tell you is that if my father was not so sentimental about old attachments, you would be driving for tender tomorrow. I am sick of your Euro-trash duplicity." "Paco, please!"
There was a light amusement in the father's voice. His English, Chris noticed, had a mannered Southern States drawl to it, at odds with the Myaspanic rhythms of his son's speech.
"These gentlemen have an apology to make. It will be rude not to hear them out."
So. Chris saw how Makin tautened. He wasn't sure if the father and son noticed.
"Certainly," Mike Bryant said smoothly. "There has been a serious misunderstanding, and I do feel that the responsibility is ours. When my colleague brought our files on the rebels to your attention, he perhaps did not stress enough that we were concerned."
Echevarria Jr. rasped something indistinct in Spanish. His father looked in his direction, and he shut up. Bryant nodded grateful acknowledgement to the father and picked up the threads again.
"We were concerned that perceived instability was going to draw new and less scrupulous investors than ourselves."
Hernán Echevarria smiled bleakly from around the globe.
"This instability you speak of has been dealt with. And you're right, Señor Bryant. That was not how your colleague presented the matter."
One of the peripheral screens woke into static prior to transmission.
"Would you like to see the message?"
Bryant raised a hand.
"We've all seen the message, General. I don't propose to take up any more of your valuable time here than absolutely necessary. As I said, it was a case of poor communication for which we take full responsibility."
He looked pointedly at Makin.
"General Echevarria,"
it sounded as if the words were being gripped out of Makin with pliers,
"I apologize, unconditionally, for any misunderstanding I have caused. It was never my intention to suggest that we would be interested in dealing with your political enemies."
"The enemies of my country, senor. The enemies of our national honor. Of all Colombian patriots. Condemned, you will recall, by the Catholic Church and every other symbol of decency in the Americas."
"Yes," Makin said stiffly. "As you say."
"I have something here," Bryant came to his rescue, "which you may be interested in."
One of the recessed screens flickered to life, and Chris knew that on the other side of the world the Echevarrias were watching the image emerge from somewhere over Mike Bryant's shoulder.
"This is some of the primary documentation you received from us in its original format," said Bryant, steering the control mouse with one casual hand. "As you'll see from the blow-up, it is not a document originating from Sean. In fact, this, as I'm sure you'll recognize, is the logo of Hammett McColl."
It could have been computer-generated fakery, and everyone in the room knew it, but Echevarria had invited H.M. out to the name himself the year before, and he knew it fit.
"Where did you get this?"
he asked.
"From a source,"
Echevarria Jr. erupted again in mother-related Spanish insults. Bryant waited him out. The father silenced the son again, this time with an irritated gesture.
"What sauce?"
"At this stage," Bryant said carefully, "I'm not prepared to reveal that information. A source is only useful so long as it remains secure, and this link-up is not. However," he caught the bristling on the sun and moved to beat it, "in a genuine face-to-face situation I would be happy to discuss all and any details pertaining to this matter. I feel that we owe you a certain candor after the weekend's confusion."
"You are suggesting I fly to London?"
Bryant spread his hands. "In your own time, naturally. I'm aware that you have a number of pressing engagements at home."
"Yes,"
Echevarria smiled again, with about as much warmth as before.
"Notably, clearing up the mess created by one of your agents."
Mike sighed. "General, I've done what I can to demonstrate our good faith. I give you my word." A repressed snarl from Echevarria Jr.
"That whatever this man was doing in Medellin, it was not at our request. He may have been operating at the behest of Hammett McCall or someone else. I do not deny that our source in HM could very well have sold the same data to anyone else willing to pay corporate prices. I understand this. Person, let us say, has good contacts in both New York and Tokyo, and—"
"All right, Signor Bryant. I believe I have heard this excuse. You have offered a face-to-face meeting. To what end?"
"Well," Mike went back to the mouse. The HM document faded and was replaced by one of the hardware lists he'd shown Chris the week before. "There is an outstanding question over the matter of military equipment. In view of these new developments and the disturbances they are bound to cause, I had it in mind to review the budget." Chris caught the reaction. He wondered how Mike managed not to grin.
"You are saying?"
"Next month, London hosts the North Memorial Arms Fair. I am suggesting that you kill two birds with one stone and that we visit the fair together with an eye to your immediate requirements. While you are here, we can discuss the matter of Hammett McCall's information and its U.S. implications." Echevarria's eyes narrowed.
"U.S. implications?"
"I'm sorry, I meant international implications." Mike did a good imitation of embarrassment. "I tend to leap to conclusions that cannot always be justified, but, well, we can discuss this further when you're in London." After that it was just noise. Bryant layered on the apologies with a couple of wheeled-in words from Macon. Echevarria Jr. growled and snapped at intervals, always brought to heel by his father, who just looked thoughtful throughout. Goodbyes were said cordially enough. Mike came storming back into the viewing chambers and slammed the door behind him.
"Get on to Lopez. I want contact with the rebels by the end of the week. This motherfucker is going to turn on us."
Chris blinked.
"I thought you'd hooked him."
"Yeah, for the moment. The military staff ought to hold him for a while, and that smear about U.S. involvement will stave off Junior's Miami connections. But in the end, it's a slum block waiting to come down. Old Hannon doesn't really buy anything we said in there, and he's just biding his time to see what he can get out of us. And he's not going to stay bribed with a handful of cheap cluster bombs, which is about all we can afford right now, the state things are in. No, the Americans are going to get him sooner or later, and I want a player of our own in position before that happens."
"Yeah, but who?"
Chris gestured out through the glass to where Macon still sat at the table, staring into the middle distance.
"Fuckhead there managed to trash Diaz. Who does that leave us?"
"We'll have to go with Barranco."
"Barranco?"
"Chris, he's what we've got. You said yourself Arbenz isn't going to be in any position to lead an armed insurrection this year."
"Yeah, but Barranco. He's committed, Mike."
"Ah, come on. They all start out that way."
"No, he's a real fucking Guevara, Mike. I don't think we're going to be able to control him."
Bryant grinned. "Yeah, we will. You will."
He glanced back through at Macon. The other executive hadn't moved.
"I'm going to take this shit to Hewitt and get Nick reassigned. It's high fucking time. Meanwhile, you get Barranco to sit down. I don't care what it takes. Fly out there yourself if you have to, but get him to the table."
There was a brief rush off the words.
an image from the Hamet McCall visit, a Caribbean night sky shingled with stars, the warm darkness beneath, and the noises of the nighttime street.
You want me to go out to Panama?
If that's what it takes.
Hewitt isn't going to like this. She gave the account to Macon in the first place. It isn't going to look good if he's written off as the wrong choice. And that's without her feelings about me. She's hardly a fan.
Chris, you're fucking paranoid.
I told you before, Hewitt's a fan of money, and right now you're making plenty of it. Bottom line, that's what counts.
Mike grinned again. And anyway, she gives me any static, I'll go talk to Notley. You are in, my friend, like it or not. Welcome to the name account.
Out in the conference room, Macon stirred in his chair and turned to look toward them. It was as if he'd heard the conversation. He looked beaten and betrayed. Chris stared back at him, trying to chase out a faint disquiet that would not go away. Thanks.
Hey, you earned it.
Run with it. Bryant slung an arm around his shoulders.
Besides, we're a fucking team. Now let's kick Hernan Echevarria into touch and make some fucking money.
Chapter 23. Someone had tied up a damaged speedboat beside the jetty and then left it to drown. The boat's prow was raised, roped tightly to a mooring iron, but behind the fly-specked windshield the water was up over the pale leather-upholstered interior almost to the dashboard. Chris saw a fish hanging suspended below the surface like a tiny zeppelin, nibbling at something on the lower arc of the submerged steering wheel. Twigs and decaying leaf matter floated around the sunken stern, shifting sloppily back and forth as the wake of a passing water taxi rolled up to the jetty. Wavelets slapped at the wooden supports. Out across the lagoon, low cloud adhered like grey candy floss to trees on the islands and drifted across the seaward view, trailing rain. The sun was a vague blot on the lighter grey overhead. The air was warm and clammy. Chris turned away. It wasn't the Caribbean as he remembered it. He went back to where Joaquin Lopez sat with his back to the wooden shack that justified the jetty's existence.
You sure he's coming?
Lopez shrugged. He was a tall, tightly muscled man, mostly Afro-Caribbean, and he radiated a calm at odds with the panic he'd shown over the phone from Medellin.
He has every reason to. I wouldn't have brought you for nothing, man. Smoke?
Chris shook his head. Lopez lit a cigarette for himself and plumed smoke out across the water. He scratched absently at a scar on his forehead.
It will not have been easy for him. There's a lot of heat along this part of the coast. The Turtle Patrol have authority to stop and search anyone they think is poaching, and you sometimes got U.S. drug enforcement boats up from the Darien. They don't have any authority, but...
He shrugged again. Chris nodded.
When did that ever stop them, right?
Right.
Lopez looked away and grinned.
What?
Nothing. You don't talk like a gringo.
Chris yawned. He hadn't slept much in the last couple of days.
I'll take that as a compliment.
Keep it up. It may help with Barranco.
It was piling up behind his eyes now. London, Madrid, San Jose, Costa Rica. A blur of airports, executive lounges in muted pastel shades, the grey whisper of air-conditioned flight. Chasing down the sun, gaining a day. Helicoptered out of San Jose at dawn and across the border into Panama, touchdown on a sun-drenched airfield outside David, where Lopez had sneaked out of Panama City and west to meet him. Another short hop north to Bocas del Toro, a series of shacks and people Lopez knew, a gun on loan, a water taxi out here, wherever exactly it was, and waiting, waiting for Barranco.
You ever meet him?
Lopez shook his head.
Spoke to him on the video phone a couple of days ago. He's looking tired, not like the pin-ups they did of him back in 41. He needs this, Chris. This is his last throw.
The year echoed in his head. In 41, Edward Quain had died in smeared fragments on the cold asphalt of the M-20. At the time, it had seemed like some kind of ending. But Chris had woken the next day to find the world intact, and nothing he'd begun at Hamet McCall even close to tidy, let alone finished. It had dawned on him only then that he'd have to go on living, and that he'd have to find some new reason to do it. A soft snarling, out across the water.
"Boat coming," said Lopez.
The vessel came into view around a forested headland, raising a bow wave to match the noise of its engines. It was a big, navy-grey vessel, built for speed and, judging by the twinned machine guns mounted behind an impact glass cupola on the foredeck, for assault. A flag flapped at the stern, white design on a green background. Lopez breathed a sigh of relief when he saw it.
"Turtle patrol," he said.
The powerboat slowed and settled in the water as the motors cut to an idle. It nosed into the jetty, and someone dressed in khakis came up on the foredeck. Yells in Spanish. Lopez responded. The deckhand gathered up a line and jumped blithely to the jetty with it. He landed with a practiced flex in the legs. A woman, similarly attired, came and leaned on the machine gun cupola, staring at them. Chris felt caution creep through
him. "You're armed too, right?" he muttered to Lopez.
"Sure, but these are turtle guys. They aren't..."
The next man off the boat wore the same army fatigues and had a Kalashnikov assault rifle slung over his shoulder. He passed Chris without a glance, ambled up to Lopez and rapped out something in Spanish. When he got the answer, he disappeared into the shack behind them. Chris looked at the water on the other side of the jetty and wondered how deep it was. He'd want a good half-meter over his head to be sure of not getting shot. The Smith & Wesson Lopez had lent him was apparently guaranteed to fire wet, but against assault rifles... Let's face it, Chris, you wouldn't last 5 minutes. This isn't a Tony Carpenter flick.
"Signor Faulkner?"
He jerked back to the boat. Another khaki-clad figure had joined the woman on the foredeck. As the man vaulted to the jetty, Chris caught up with a voice. It was Barranco. It was the same weathered set of features Chris remembered from the HM meeting just over a year ago, a face darkened by sun and altitude, broad across the cheekbones, chipped with the blue of eyes tossed into the gene pool by some European colonist decades or centuries absorbed. The same close-cropped greying hair, the same height and length of limb as Barranco moved to greet him, the same calloused grip, the same search in the eyes when you got up close. It was a gaze that belonged on the bridge of some warship from the last century, or maybe the last of the pirate trawlers, scanning the grey horizon for signs.
"Señor Faulkner, I remember you now, from the Hammett McCall mission, the man with the laptop. You were very quiet then."
"I came to listen." Chris reached into his jacket. "This time I..."
"Very easy, please." Barranco raised his own hands. "My companions are a little nervous this far from home, and it wouldn't do to let them think you're planning to use that badly concealed gun in your belt."
He gestured in turn at a woman by the cupola and the first deckhand ashore, who now straightened from the mooring iron with a pistol gripped in one fist. Chris heard the snap of a weapon being cocked, looked back at the shack, and saw the man with the assault rifle emerge from the building again, weapon cradled at his hip.
"So," said Barranco, "welcome again to Latin America."
The interior of the shack was equipped with basic facilities. A toilet behind a wall of plastic partitioning, a tiny stove in a corner, an ancient wooden table 2 meters long, scarred with decades of use and carved with what looked like whole generations of graffiti. Half a dozen tired-looking plastic molded chairs were gathered around the table, Chris's choice from among the untidy pile they'd found behind the shack when they arrived. Hardly Shawn Conference standard. The windows were small and liberally grimed, but bulbs from an aqualite system hung suspended at intervals in the roof space, and the long uptake taper was still intact, dangling down through a crudely bored hole in the floorboards and into the water below the pilings. Chris had tested the system earlier, and the taper was well soaked. Now he flipped the wall switch, and gentle light sprang up in 3 out of the 5 bulbs. Barranco glanced around the shack and nodded.
"Well, it's not the Panama Hilton," he said, "but then I suppose I am not Luis Montoya."
It seemed to require a reaction. Chris tried a chuckle and gestured toward the table.
"Please sit down, Signor Branco. I'm afraid our concern so far has been security rather than comfort. Outside of one or two deluded drug enforcement diehards, Luis Montoya has no real enemies in the Americas. You, unfortunately, have many."
"A problem you are offering to solve for me, no?"
Branco did not sit down. Instead, he nodded at his own security, two of whom had followed him in. Without a word, they moved to positions at the windows and took up an at-ease stance that fooled no one. Neither of them spared Chris more than a glance, and that filled with easy contempt. Chris walked to the table and pulled out the chair for Branco.
"I'm sure that, given time and a little luck, a man such as yourself is probably capable of solving the problem without any help from men like me. Given time and luck. Please, have a seat."
Branco didn't move.
"I am not susceptible to flattery."
Chris shrugged and took the seat for himself. "I didn't think you were. I was making a statement of fact. I believe, which is to say we, my colleagues at Sean and I, believe you are capable of resolving a number of the issues facing Colombia at present. That is why I am here. This visit is a demonstration of our faith in you." It brought Branco to the table, slowly.
"You call it Colombia," he said. "Is that how your colleagues refer to it in London?"
"No, of course not." Chris brushed at the tabletop and held up his hands, seeking the gaze of Branco's security before he reached slowly into his jacket and brought out the folded laptop. He thought he made it look pretty cool, considering.
"We call it the North Andean Monitored Economy, as I'm sure you're aware. As I'm also sure you're aware, we are hardly alone in this."
"No."
There was a flat bitterness in the words. Branco's hands had fallen on the back of the chair opposite Chris.
"You are not. The whole world call us that way. Only that son of a whore in Bogota uses the name Colombia as if we were still a nation."
"Hernán Echevarria," Chris said softly, "milks the patriotism of his countrymen to shore up a regime that rewards the top 5% of the country with riches and keeps the remainder with their faces in the dirt. You do not need me to tell you this. But I think you need me to help you do something about it."
"How quickly we move!"
There was a look on Branco's face as if he could smell something bad seeping through the plastic partition from the toilet.
"How quickly, from flattery to bribery! Did you not say that a man such as myself could resolve?"
"Given time." Chris locked gazes, made sure he'd stopped the other man, then set placidly about unfolding the laptop. "I said, given time. And given luck. And I said, probably."
"I see."
Chris wasn't looking at him, but Branco sounded as if he was smiling. "How quickly we move. From a sneer to a smile." But he didn't look up yet. The laptop was heavily creased in a couple of places, and it was taking a while to warm up. He busied himself with flattening out the screen. He heard the chair opposite him scrape out. Heard it take Branco's weight. The screen lit with a map of the monitored economy. Chris looked up and smiled. Later, with the numbers wrung out to dry, they walked out along the jetty and stood at the end, watching the weather. To the east, the sky was clearing in patches.
"Smoke?"
Branco asked him.
"Yeah, thanks."
Chris took the proffered packet and shook out a crumpled cylinder. Branco lit it for him from a battered silver gasoline lighter that bore engraving in Cyrillic around a skull and crossbones and the date 2007. Chris drew deep and promptly coughed himself to tears on the smoke.
"Whoa!"
He took the cigarette out of his mouth and blinked at it.
"Where'd you get these?"
"A shop you haven't been to."
Branco pointed what looked like southwest.
700 kilometers from here up in the mountains. It's run by an old woman who remembers the day Echevarria took power. She won't sell American brands. It's black tobacco."
"Yeah, I noticed."
Chris took another, more cautious draw on the cigarette and felt it bite in his lungs. He gestured.
"And the lighter?"
Military issue, right?
Wrong!
Branko held up the lighter again, rubbing a finger back and forth across the Cyrillic characters.
Advertising. It says, death cigarettes. Too bad you're going to die. But it's, what do you call it in English? A knockout, an illegal copy.
Knockoff.
Yes, a knockoff. Some crazy English guy back in the last century. He actually made cigarettes with that name.
Doesn't sound too smart. Branko turned and breathed smoke at him.
At least he was honest.
Chris let that one sit for a while. Branko wandered the width of the jetty, smoking, waiting him out.
I think you should come to London, Signor Branko. You need...
Are your parents still alive, Signor Faulkner?
It stabbed him through, punctured the slowly inflating sense of a deal done that was filling him up. No.
Do you remember them?
He shot a glance across at the face of the man beside him and knew this was not negotiable. This was required.
My father died when I was young, he said, surprised at how easy it had become to say. I don't remember him well. My mother died later, when I was in my teens, of thorn fever.
Baranko's eyes narrowed.
What is that? Thorn fever?
Chris smoked for a moment, checking his memories for leakage before he answered. He thought he had it locked down.
It's a TB variant, one of the antibiotic-resistant strains. We lived in the zones, what you call the favelas, and there's a lot of it there. She couldn't afford the smart drugs. No one there can, so she just took basic ABs until she collapsed. No one's sure what killed her in the end. The thorn fever or something else her immune system was too wasted to cope with.
It took... He didn't have it locked down. He looked away.
I am sorry, said Branko.
It...
Chris swallowed.
Thanks, it's okay. It was a long time ago.
He drew on the cigarette again, grimaced suddenly, and flung it away from him into the water. He pressed the back of his index finger against his eyes, one by one, and looked at the scant streaks of moisture it left.
My mother was taken away, said Branko from behind him, in the night, by soldiers. It was common at the time. I, too, was in my teens. My father had long ago left us, and I was out at a political meeting. Perhaps it was me they came for, but they took her instead.
Chris knew. He'd read the file.
They raped her, Echevarria's men. They tortured her for days, with electricity and with a broken bottle, and then they shot her in the face and left her to die on a garbage dump at the edge of town. A doctor from La Amnestia told me they think it took her about 2 hours.
He would have said, sorry, but the word seemed broken, drained of useful content.
Do you understand why I am fighting, Signor Faulkner? Why I have been fighting for the last 20 years?
Chris shook his head, wordless. He turned to face Branko and saw that the other man had no more emotion on his face than he'd shown when they were discussing cigarettes.
You don't understand, Signor Faulkner?
Branko shrugged.
Well, I cannot blame you. Sometimes neither do I. Some days it makes more sense to take my Kalashnikov, walk into any police station or barracks bar and kill everything that wears a uniform. But I know that behind those men are others who wear no uniform. So I change this plan, and I begin to think that I should do the same thing with a government building. But then I remember that these people in turn are only the front for an entire class of landowning families and financiers who call themselves my compatriots. My head spins with new targets.
Branko gestured.
Banks, ranches, gated suburbs. The numbers for slaughter rise like a lottery total. And then I remember that Hernán Echevarría would not have lasted a year in power, not a single year, if he had not had support from Washington and New York.
He raised a finger and pointed at Chris.
And London. Are you sure, Signor Faulkner, that you want me in your capital city?
Chris, still busy hauling back in the emotional canvas, mustered a shrug of his own. His voice rasped a little in his throat.
I'll take the chance.
Brave man. Branko finished his own cigarette and pinched it out between finger and thumb.
I suppose. A brave man or a gambler? Which should I call you?
Call me a judge of character. I think you're smart enough to be trusted.
I'm flattered. And your colleagues?
My colleagues will listen to me. This is what I get paid for.
Yes, I suppose it is.
Chris caught the drip of it in Barranco's voice, the same thing he'd seen in the other Marquista's eyes in the shack.
Fuck.
He'd overplayed it. Too much macho boardroom acceleration coming off the emotional bend. He was leaning in for damage limitation, but what he wanted to say twisted loose on its way out. Aghast, he heard himself telling the truth. Raw.
What have you got to lose? You're in ship-poor shape, Vicente.
We both know that. Backed up in the mountains, outgunned, living on rhetoric.
If Echevarría comes for you now the way he did for Diaz, your history.
Like Marcos. Like Guevara. A beautiful legend and a fucking T-shirt. Is that what you want? All those people in the name, going through what your mother went through. What good are you to them like that? For a moment, that froze as the last word left his mouth. He imagined the world caving in around him with the deal. Branco's eyes hardened. His stance tightened. Telegraphed so clear it sent the security guard on the patrol boat's deck smoothly to her feet. An assault rifle hefted. Chris's breath stopped.
I mean... I know what you mean.
Branco's posture relaxed first. He turned to the woman on the boat and made a sign. She sank back to her seat. When he turned back, something had changed in his face.
I know what you mean, because this is the first time you've come out and said it. You can't imagine how much of a relief that is, Chris Faulkner. You can't imagine how little all your numbers have meant to me without some sign that you have a soul.
Chris breathed again. You should have asked.
Asked if you had a soul?
There wasn't much humor in Branco's parched laugh.
Is that a question that can be asked in London? When I am seated around the table with your colleagues, discussing what slices of my country's GDP I must offer up to gain their support? What crops my people must grow while their own children starve? What essential medical services they must learn to live without? Will I ask them where they keep their souls then, Signor Faulkner?
I wouldn't advise it, no.
No. Then what would you advise?
Chris waited up. Fuck it. It's worked so far. And told the unbandaged truth again.
I'd advise you to get what you can from them with as little commitment on your side as possible, because that's what they'll be doing to you.
Leave yourself escape clauses. Remember, nothing's ever written in stone. Everything can be renegotiated if you can make it worth their while. A pause. Branco laughed again, warmth leaking into the sound this time. He offered the cigarettes again, lit them both with a Russian knockoff.
Good advice, my friend, he said through the smoke. Good advice. I think I would hire you as an advisor if I could afford you.
You can. I'm part of the package.
No.
The trawlerman's gaze settled on him.
I know a little about you now, Chris Faulkner, and you are not part of any package in London. There is something in you that resists incorporation. Something...
Branco shrugged.
Honorable.
It flickered across his memory before he could stop it. Liz Linshaw's body in the white silk gown that untied and opened like a gift, the curves and shadowed places within, the sound of her laugh. "I think you are mistaken about me," he said quietly. Branko shook his head.
"You will see. I am not a bad judge of character myself when it counts. You may get paid by these people, but you are not one of them. You do not belong."
Lopez got him back to Bocas by nightfall, and they sat in a waterfront café waiting for the late flight to David. Across the water, the sequin twinkle of restaurant lights on another island seemed threaded directly onto the darkness. Local-owned bungas puttered about in the channel between, cruising for taxi custom. Voices drifted out over the water like smoke, Spanish shot through with an occasional English loanword. Kitchen noise clattered in the back of the café behind them. The whole meeting with Branko already seemed like a dream.
"So, it went well?" Lopez asked.
Chris stirred at his cocktail. "Seems that way. He's going to come to London anyway." His mind cut loose the replays of Liz Linshaw and went wearily to work. "I want you to set that up as soon as possible. But safe. Above all, safe. Quick as you can without endangering his life or his strategic position. I'll move things around at my end to fit in with whatever that means."
"Billing?"
"Through the covert account. I don't want this to show up until... No. Better yet, you pay for it yourself. Cash. I'll have the money dumped to you in Zurich soon as I get back. Mail me an advance estimate at the hotel tomorrow morning. Oh, yeah. You got anything that'll help me sleep?"
"Not on me."
Lopez dug out his phone.
"You're at the Sheraton, right?"
"Yeah. 1101. Jenkins." The phone screen showed a cozy green glow. Lopez punched his way down a list and held up the instrument to face him. After a couple of rings, a voice answered in Spanish.
"En inglés, güey,"
Lopez said impatiently. Whoever he was looking at grumbled something filthy and then switched.
"You're here in town, man?"
"No, but a friend of mine will be shortly, and he needs a little something to help him sleep."
"Is he a fizzy?"
Lopez looked up from the phone at Chris.
"You do a lot of this sort of stuff?"
"Christ, no."
The America's agent dropped his gaze to the phone screen again.
"Definitely not. Something gentle."
"Got it. Address?"
"Sheraton, room 1101, Mr. Jenkins."
"Charge card or account?"
"Very fucking funny. Hasta luego."
"Hasta la cuento, amigo."
He folded up the phone.
"Staff will be waiting for you at the desk. You go in, just ask if you got any messages. There'll be an envelope."
"You can vouch for this guy, right?"
"Yeah, he's a plastic surgeon."
Chris couldn't see why that was supposed to reassure him, but he was getting past caring. The thought of crushing his jet lag beneath the soft black weight of 7 or 8 hours of chemically guaranteed sleep was like a finishing line ahead. Liz Linshaw, Mike Bryant, and Sean, Carlo, Branko, and the skipper's eye scrutiny in his gaze. He let them all go like a pack he'd been carrying. Sleep was coming. He'd worry about everything else tomorrow. But behind the aching relief, Branko's words floated like the voices out on the water. "You do not belong." Chapter 24. He woke in the standard-issue luxury of the Sheraton to the softly insistent pulse of an incoming signal from his laptop. He flopped over and glared blearily around the room. Located the fucking thing, there on the carpeted floor amid the trail of his dropped clothes. "Blee, blee, fucking blee." He groaned and groped, half out of bed, one hand holding his body rigidly horizontal off the floor. He snagged the machine, dragged it onto the bed, and sat up to unfold it in his lap. Mike Bryant's recorded face grinned out at him.
"Morning. If I timed this right, I figure you've got about 3 hours before your flight, so here's something to think about while you're waiting. You are under attack, and this time you are going down."
Groggy from the plastic surgeon's special delivery, Chris felt a sluggish spasm of alarm rip through him. Then the other man's face blinked out, and a stylized chessboard took its place. Mike had launched an unlooked-for rook-and-night assault on him while he slept. It looked bad.
Motherfucker!
He got up and shambled about, packing. Still not flushed clean of the sleeping fix, he reacted unwisely to Mike's gambit over breakfast and lost a bishop. Bryant, it seemed, was playing in real time. He went to the airport, smarting from the loss, and picked up the pieces in the exec lounge. It was Saturday, and Mike, if he'd known what was good for him, should have let the game ride for the weekend. He could have thought it out over the next couple of days and taken Chris apart at leisure, but Chris knew him better. Bryant was lit up with the taste of his victory, and he'd stay in real-time play now. View, absorb, react. All night, if he had to. Chris had lent him Rakimov's speed chess and the attack momentum a couple of months ago, and the big man had swallowed it whole. He was in for the kill. Somewhere over the Caribbean, Chris beat off the attack. It cost him his only remaining knight, and his carefully constructed castled defense was in ruins, but Mike's attack momentum was down. The flurry of moves slowed. Chris played doggedly across the Atlantic, and by the time they touched down in Madrid, he had Bryant nailed to a lucky stalemate. Mike sent him a Tony Carpenter clip attachment in response, the post-fight standoff from the deceiver. Carpenter's trademark lack of acting talent, lines creaking with the burden of cliché. We are well matched, you and I, we should fight on the same side. It was so bad it was almost camp. Chris grinned and folded the laptop. He got off the flight with a bounce in his step, grabbed a sauna and a shower in the exec lounge while he waited, and slept naturally on the shuttle back to London. He dreamed of Liz Linshaw. At Heathrow, leaning on the barrier at intervals, made up and dressed in clothes that hugged at her figure, Carla was waiting.
"No, it's just... you didn't need to. You know, I'm running on the Shawn clock. They'd pick up the tab for a taxi all the way home." "I wanted to see you." "So why the fuck do you go to Tromso?"
He bit it back and watched the curving perspectives of the road ahead. Saturday morning traffic on the orbital was sparse, and Carla, with the easy confidence of the professional mechanic, had the Saab up to 150 in the middle lane.
"How is your mum?"
"She's good. Busy. They want to bring out an interactional version of the new book, so she's been rewriting, slotting in the go-to sections with some data rat from the university."
"Is she shagging him?"
It didn't quite come out right. Too harsh. Too much silence around it. There was a time Chris could get away with these riffs on Kirsty's sex life, and Carla used to laugh in mock outrage. Now she just looked across at him and went back to watching the road, tight-lipped. The chill filled the car almost palpably.
"Sorry, I..."
"That was nasty."
"It wasn't meant to be."
Helplessly.
"What the fuck is happening to us, Carla? What the fuck are we doing here? Is it just me? Is it?"
He saw Liz Linshaw again, the easy smile in the spare room, face and hair dappled with street lighting through the tree outside, the glass of water in her hand. She had navigated the moment with the same ease that Carla drove the Saab. Stepping closer than necessary to hand him the water, the warm tang of whiskey on her breath, a soft, surprised, "Oh," in ladylike tones, her news